pals o' mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. I was watching a promo the other night for the TV show Once Upon a Time, and thought, not for the first time, that the producers of that show and Grimm were really smart to tap into that deep well of resources that are known as fairy tales. Coincidentally, I attended a book fair a few days after that, and I met Linda Champion, who wrote Fairy Tales for Life, a collection of 14 original short stories. Similar to the classic, her fairy tales offered morality, values, lessons learned. Would you like to hear one of the stories? The Duet of Love. The woman sat in a dark room. She was trying to hide from her sad thoughts. She had lost her love for the second time. She wondered if she would ever again reach out to another person. Would she be willing to step up to the precipice and plunge head over heels into the arms of another? Well, there was no time to think about it now. She shook off her gloom and, gathering herself together, started out of her little house on her way to the town square. Today was her turn to play her flute. Everyone in the village took turns in providing entertainment, always at the noon hour. All the people would gather together, coming out of their homes and pausing in their daily pursuits to watch and listen to whatever was offered by their neighbors. It was the way of the town to share in the making of art in all its various forms. Some played instruments like the woman, and others painted pictures or carved figures. The woman hurried to the square. Sitting down on a stool, she put her flute to her lips and began to play a tune. The people gathered round, and as they listened, they nodded their heads in agreement that this was a very sweet melody. "Ah, but it is such a sad little tune," they thought. As the woman continued to play the flute, something magical began to happen. The woman's tune began to rise into the air. It traveled far and wide, reaching out to many of the inhabitants for miles around, even traveling across the great sea that could only be seen from the mountaintops. It was in search of a person who would understand the meaning of the woman's music, someone who would respond to its call. Dear reader, it so happened that on the other side of the sea, there was a young man who had also had his share of heartache. Sitting in his hut, he poured out his heart in words he scribbled onto a scrap of paper. As he wrote, the woman's tune hovered over his small home. It lingered there and then drifted inside, repeating over and over again its musical refrain. The man stopped what he was doing and listened. He could hear the beat of a kindred spirit. Picking up his pen, he began to write with renewed vigor. His words now matched the notes of the woman's music. Together, a song formed. The words blended with the music, almost like they had always been as one. United, they lifted into the air and floated back over the great sea, over the mountaintops, and into the ear of the woman who was still playing her flute. She was enchanted by the man's words. Gradually, she began to sense that these musings might be the response that she so dearly longed for, the beginning of a new love. She played her flute with passion, responding to the words the man had written. The townspeople began to notice the change in the woman's face and in her playing. Where she had looked so sad, she now appeared hopeful and even radiant. Her music had also changed, now becoming quite cheerful with ascending runs and trills. All the men, women, and children prayed for her, hoping this change would continue. Would her tune be able to bring her the dream that she had always had in her heart? Everyone continued to pray as the woman played on. Though so far away, the man could clearly hear the woman's tune. He now knew that he must follow it, wherever it led him. Packing up his belongings, he began what became a long journey. He traveled on foot, then by boat over the sea, and then climbed over the great mountaintops. Always, he could hear the woman's music. She continued to play her flute for days and days, not stopping for food or drink. Then early one morning, the man walked up to her and asked, "Do you believe in love?" She put down her flute and replied, "Yes, I do." With this, the man sang to her, "I heard your tune from across the sea. It found my heart and made it beat. Oh, won't you come and marry me?" "I will," answered the woman. And so the two spent the rest of their lives making many happy songs together, with music from the woman and words from the man. It became, as you may have already guessed, a duet of love that lasted forever and ever. The end. And now here's my interview with the author herself, Linda Champion.
So first, your directions for me to your home was look for the blue tiled roof.
Right.
And then I entered, and there was all sorts of little goodies in here.
Lots of old things, right? And I always think that if something has a little bit of age to it, then it usually has a story to tell. You know, and it's kind of fun if you can find out something about the pieces that we've added to our house that adds. Or if not, if we don't have a story, it doesn't come with a story, we make up stories. And some of these pieces of furniture have ended up in my fairy tales, like the clock that you saw over here. I want to welcome you to our home, and I'm glad that you like tea, because we like tea too, and I think that's always a good way to start. When people come over here, that's the first thing I ask is, would you like some tea? And then they pick their teacup.
And I selected one with a yellow rose.
It goes
with
nicely
orange
with your
tint.
Hair. I think it was a good choice.
No one can see it. The first thing my eyes caught on was your Vitrola. Because we have one in our family, my great-grandfather. Ah. But yours is a different model. But tell me how you got a hold of that.
Well, this
piece.
It's very old, but it's a new acquisition. This belonged to Ken's cousin, who was in her 80s. We'd go visit her. Her name was Lucille Spickelmeyer. Isn't that a great name? And it has great music, but it also has clips of vaudeville acts from the 1920s. And I was totally enthralled with that. So I liked it so much. So unfortunately, Ken's cousin passed away a couple of months ago. So her daughter decided that I should have this Victrola. And she said, "Well, are you going to have enough room?" Because she'd seen my house. And I know it's kind of that Victorian clutter look, you know, but that's what I like. And so, "Were you going to have a place to put this?" And I said, "No problem." So you can see I found the perfect place.
Yes, because it's tall and narrow.
Right.
So it doesn't really take up a lot of space.
No, it wasn't bad at all. And it's a lot of fun. You're just listening to the sound of these old records. It really takes you backwards in time. You know,
so. A little scratchy.
Well, some less, but I think that adds to the overall effect. So
what are some of the pieces that came with it?
Oh, the one about King Tut is really, really, really funny. In the 1920s, you know, the King Tut's tomb was uncovered. And I found that all these records, they tend to have at least a bit somewhere of humor running through them. And that's my favorite one, is the King Tut one. All kinds of different acts that I really enjoy, which I think are funnier than what you find today. Out there, it's my opinion.
Speaking of music, you've got a beautiful piano.
And that's a Baldwin. And that piano is over 113 years old. And it's amazing that it still plays beautifully. And when we had a party here, my last birthday, we had some wonderful musicians come. My husband and I are both musicians. And what I wanted for my birthday was to have this jazz combo. Paula Dula, who's a jazz singer, and she came with her pianist and a bass player. He really made this piano sing out. It's a marvelous piano, and again, it's 113 years old. Most pianos don't really hold up, but this one has, luckily. Even has three pedals, which is what you have to look for when you're looking for an older piano. And also what's really wonderful, actually amazing, is that the keys, when you look at them, they're ivory and they're all intact. So whoever had this piano definitely loved this piano and took good care of it.
Yeah, they aren't chipped, what you see sometimes, or yellowed.
Mm-hmm. We found it in San Anselmo. It was really nice. Each piece in our house, it has a story of Ken and I looking high and low for whatever we were looking for at that moment. And we've spent many years looking for that exact piece that we wanted to put in this one particular corner. And we saw a lot of really unfortunate really beat up pianos. They said, "We've got the piano for you," and then you would show up. And I felt so sorry for the piano because it looked like it had been thrown from a truck or something, really in bad shape. So after going through a lot of very sad-looking pianos, we came across this one in San Anselmo. And it was just a case where she had bought it for her daughter. Her daughter didn't really pick up on piano playing, and so she has stuck with the piano. I paid her more than she asked for it because out of kind of respect to the piano, I didn't want to give her the price because, like I say, this was a really nice piano. I always felt like the piano had a personality and would have been insulted if I had paid less.
So tell me about some of the other large pieces that you have.
Well, we have, especially upstairs, we have some really large pieces. Probably the largest one is a 7-foot tall headboard. It's part of it's Charles Eastlake style furniture, which is also known as Gothic style. And that's quite large, okay? And like I say, it's taller than
I am. 7 foot. That's
7 foot. Yes, and what's amazing is we found the matching sideboard to go with in the mirror, which is hard to find because mainly you find Charles Eastlake either Midwest or the East Coast. You don't find very many of them on the West Coast. Downstairs, this set, I have a lot of fond memories of. This belonged to my great-grandmother. This set's over 100 years old, too.
A couch and chairs.
Yeah, yes, and the rocker. And
so a lot of sitting in the past.
Yes, and actually, I remember my great-grandmother quite well. I have her portrait upstairs.
So what was your great-grandmother's name?
Agnes Doan.
So tell me about Agnes.
Well, Agnes was up in Lassen, and she was a very good fisherman, okay?
Good for her.
And she and her husband actually owned a resort that they built up there in a place called Old Station. Maybe has a population of about 200 tops, and it's up in Shasta County. So they built this resort that was originally known as Doan Hat Creek Resort, and Hat Creek is one of the main rivers up there. Agnes, but we always called her Nana. Nana was an incredible fisherman, and her daughter was also an incredible fisherman. So we've got a lot of really incredible fisher women, in our family. And I remember going up there as a child and fishing with my great-grandmother and my grandmother.
So what you're saying is, the old fishing stories, the one that got away, the storytelling.
Yes.
May have originated back then.
They were great storytellers, especially my grandmother. She would tell them over and over again. I'm glad she did because there's really something wonderful about hearing a story over and over again. You tend to remember it, when she was a girl and all of her adventures because she definitely she was what you would call a free spirit. Jumping into the other side of my family, on my father's side, my Auntie Margaret, Margaret Oakley, fantastic storyteller. Her husband also was a great storyteller, but she's not the only one. Her son is also an incredible storyteller, along with being a musician. We have storytelling and we have musicianship going hand in hand in this family.
Nice.
Plus art, of course.
Now you were a teacher, is that correct?
Yes.
What did you teach? What ages?
Well, I started out with the 12, 13, and 14-year-olds, which is probably one of the more challenging age groups. And I had always wanted to teach, but I never had the opportunity until I remarried. I married Ken, and Ken said, I think I've married a school marm, because I told him I always wanted to be a teacher. So he said, yeah, go ahead and quit your secure job at Intel. I was working for the governmental affairs manager, a lobbyist, okay? And why don't you quit the job and see what you can do? And I'm so glad that he was game for that, because that's really what my dream was, to be a teacher. So I started as a substitute teacher and got kind of combat training. And a lot of my friends who were doing this, they didn't really like it, but I just found this really fun and exciting. Every day was a new adventure, to challenge my teaching ability. And I think it helped to hone my skills, so when I got a permanent job eventually, that I was able to handle it. So I did 4 years at a middle school, and then I was lucky to get to graduate along with the kids and get a school at Valley High School in the Elk Grove Unified School District. So I was there for about 11 years before I retired.
And which grades did you teach there?
Okay, I taught mainly juniors and seniors.
And subjects?
Subjects, I taught U.S. history and American government. And what we did in U.S. history is we had a lot of fun because...
I was going to say, there's got to be stories there.
Oh, yes. And I would become some of the characters that we were studying. I mean, I was FDR at one point. I was a woman suffragette. And I would dress up and I would become these interesting characters, okay? It's just, I've always had fun pretending, I guess. Part of my storytelling, and I would quit the story. My outfit that was where I was representing a woman suffragette was a lot of fun. And we would have like some school events where teachers would dress up. And I had a big sign. I was all dressed up as a woman suffragette. It's this fabulous outfit I had. And I had a big sign and it said, no vote equals no dinner.
Nice.
I was so convincing that some of the parents came up to me because it was a big school-wide activity. Everybody was walking around, and I was walking around, and I was so convincing. They asked me, "You mean women haven't gotten the right to vote?" And I had to tell them quietly,
"Oh dear,
I'm not That's kidding. Scary. I know, and that I'm not kidding." Really, and I had to very diplomatically say, "Oh, actually, I'm role playing." We did get the right to vote in 1920.
So. That would be really hard for me to be diplomatic. That would really be difficult
As
for
a
me.
Teacher, you have to be diplomatic.
I understand that. That's why I'm not a teacher. At least not formal. Well, not a formal teacher.
Yeah. And then I did a lot of role-playing. There was always an election when I was doing my U.S. history class, my American government class. We would have a mock election, and the kids ran it, and we ran it for the entire school. So, at 1,700 ballots, 1,700 kids.
Well, that's committed.
This was one of my favorite things, was really making this whole electoral process come to life. We even emulated the candidates that were running. We would do all of the presidential elections. Every time there was one, we would do one for that. And the kids would I have them see the entire debate and make sure that they have an opportunity to really digest the entire thing on their own rather than getting somebody else's version on what was what, you see. And so they had the ballot. We actually had at one point, my last year, I decided to pull all stops. So we had students representing some of the candidates, and they dressed up in suits, and we invited students to come in and watch the debate before before the vote. They did a terrific job acting as the actual candidates that were running. And then they went to classroom to classroom as if they were running for office. And then one of the funny things is one of the students, they got so involved with this that they had some students acting as the VP candidates. Also, they had the wives, of course, they were all dressed up. And one student said, "Well, you've got to have security." So as the kids came in to the classroom when they were, going like they were campaigning, one of my character students was frisking them down as making believe before they came in.
Security?
Yes. Every detail was covered for this. We walked around the campus where they made billboards, sandwich signs, and, to get the vote out. The bottom line, I was trying to emphasize how important it is to at least vote, get involved with the electoral process. I thought by doing this hands-on experience, they would get more turned on to voting.
Can you imagine if they have the current candidates?
Oh, gosh.
Wow. Be interesting to see where they
go.
That
might
be
even too much for me.
We all have our limits.
That's right. That's right.
Now, when you were a child, you were talking about musicians and dancing, you were telling me earlier.
I did ballet. I did tap, okay? And I did ballroom dancing, and I enjoyed that very much. Then you skipped to college. Okay, what happened? Kind of a funny story. I signed up for beginning folk dancing because I like to do some folk dancing. This is at San Francisco State. The computer made some kind of, had some kind of a electronic challenging situation, burped or whatever. And I ended up in the ethnic dance performing workshop that performed all over the Bay Area. And you have to be a dance major or minor to be in. I had nothing. So I walked into this class. I was like 20 years old. I had some dancing background. Oh, this looks so exciting. They're all dressing up and they were performing all over the Bay Area. By the time they caught up with me and found out that I wasn't even a dance minor, I had nothing, okay? So they said, "Well, we got to keep you." Well, they said, by that time, I was the second lead dancer. Okay, that's where I met my best friend, who was the number one dancer. They wrote me up as special studies, $199 for 3 semesters. So I got to be part of the troupe and toured all over the Bay Area doing Balkan, Serbian, Croatian dancing. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, it was important that I kept my mouth shut. I'm so glad I did that because I met my best friend, is Tanya Kanakis, who went on to become a teacher, too. She's Russian, and she's an incredible dancer.
Well, between that and ballroom, you have quite a...
Well, I had enough background to get by.
Yeah.
just keep smiling and being, very positive, so.
That was discipline fun. Also,
yeah,
from what I understand.
Yeah, I was always good at following. If somebody knows a step, if I can see it...
You can pick it up easily?
I can pick it up or I can mirror.
Well, that's also true of storytelling.
Right, being able to wing it. That's right. I've had to
wing
it many times.
Some of us call it bullshitting, but, it's storytelling.
Yes.
As a child, I knew I was going to get spanked. I had to come up with something really quick. There's a reason I did that.
I always have strange connections in my mind. But you're talking about storytelling. When I was substitute teaching, one time I was given an assignment to teach kindergarten, which is really not my era because I have a secondary teaching credential. But I said, okay, they were desperate. They had story time and I couldn't find any books. So I had to make up a story on the spot. And I had all these cute little short people all around, you know, and they were... So I said to them, do you know that Mrs. Champion, I refer to myself, you know, I says, that I'm actually part bunny. And I can prove it. They went, part bunny? So I had all had their... to rap attention. And now look at my nose. Really, don't take your eyes off my nose because I can prove it that I am part bunny. I told all this wild story about the family and how we, you know, and so what I did was this. For those of you who can't see, I can wiggle my nose. And there's a muscle that's atrophied for most Homo sapiens, except I happen to have this muscle. Because now most people can't do that. The kids were really enthralled with my story. And when they left to go home, later on, I heard the principal came up and she said, I heard your students were saying that you're part bunny and you can prove it. What's that all about, Champion? Well, luckily, she found it humorous.
Well, it is. And what's fabulous about that is, you know, they're going to remember that forever. That is stuck deep in their cell memories, which
but
is really
it was,
cool.
That was a lot of fun. But that's like thinking on your feet. You have to do something, you know, anything. You know?
Now, you're a mom. You have kids?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Were there any particular stories that your kids seem to favor to hear over and over again?
We did a lot of role-playing and pretending, you know, and my son and daughter, because I actually have kids that were biological. When I married Ken, we have 6 kids between the two of us. And so I have a combination pack here. So some of them are biological, some of them are step, and some of them are adopted. So it's a little bit of everything.
It's the American way.
Right. It's kind of a little bit of this and a little bit of that, okay? And with all of the kids, including my own kids, early on, we acted out scenes. We did plays.
You know, see how fun
and
is that?
And then my kids were, I was very proud. I taught them how to read. And so my son was reading. I kid you not, I'm not exaggerating. He was reading at 2 years. And then I had to go back to work when he was he was a little bit older than he had a sister at that point. And I didn't have as much time to spend with Suzanne, my daughter. So it was really an eye opener. We were inside this Hallmark store and I was looking to get a card for somebody. And Suzanne was only a couple of years old, okay? And she's picking up the card, and I thought she was making up little sayings that you'd find in there. But then I was shocked to find out that she had taught herself how to read. Because, as she put it, I'm going to be starting school soon, and I know that you have to be able to read. So she had picked it up on her own. Now, it's kind of phenomenal, but that's what she did. And, of course, her brother helped her. But they were all very very much into reading and play acting early on. And I did a lot of this. I've been doing a lot of the stuff with the other kids, too. The other ones, of course, by the time I married Ken, the other kids were mostly grown up. But that's why I'm skipping to the grandkids. And we've had so much fun. I've had so much fun having the kids over here, especially...
The grandkids?
My stepson... Gunner and Freedom. And this is kind of funny. When after I retired about 6 years ago and I got into writing, Gunner, who was in second grade at the time, this is not that long ago, he was telling his teacher how his grandmother was writing fairy tales, okay? And she went, yeah, sure, you know, because kids say a lot of things. Well, then he showed up with the book, okay? I was really surprised to find out after that we were going to be headed towards his classroom and we were invited to come and present one of the fairy tales. And so Ken came with me providing musical touches and we came dressed up and Gunner absolutely loved the fairy tales. I didn't realize how much he liked them because I had read him some of the stories, but he really liked them and his teacher said that he would get his work done and then he would pick up the book and reread the stories. And then when we just had him here recently, I was really touched because we were like, I was doing things with him I had done with my own kids. Of course, these are my kids and they're all our kids. We were making up stories again. And then Freedom threw in the song that's in one of my fairy tales, which goes, we two friends along the sea, how happy we are, alive and free. And so she threw that in, and it really delighted me that she, you know, had that. And they wanted to keep doing this, you know, really exhausting Ken and me, because basically picking up on the storyline of the friends, okay, where there's several animals involved. And so they had a great time in making up stories about our adventures together and what friendship is all about. they have really picked it up. Matter of fact, Frieda, when she heard that I'm writing a follow-up to my fairy tale book, so this is, original one is Fairy Tales for Life, and of course, easy, more fairy tales for life. And so Frieda was saying to me, and she's 10 years old, and she said, well, you're going to dedicate this to us, aren't you? Probably. But she and her brother have probably been the most supportive of my fairy tales. They're at a good age and we see them, you know. They're probably a strong candidates to be the object of my dedication.
Yeah, I would hope so. Now, before the fairy tales, you wrote Conversations with My Auntie Margaret About Sporty Dog.
That's right. This is how I got started in writing. My aunt, as I mentioned earlier, is a wonderful storyteller. And the way she tells these stories, her eyes twinkle, and it's very dry humor, which I just adore, and a lot of people do really like. Anyway, she had all these great stories about this dog that it was the family dog that she'd had over 70 years ago. She's still talking about this dog and all these adventures. I didn't want her stories to disappear. So I got the idea that I better capture these while I can. And she's still going strong, by the way. Don't worry about any, Margaret. So I got together with her. I bought a beautiful bottle of wine. We all love wine. Poured her a glass of wine and said, so Annie Margaret, what about Sporty Dog? And I had the little tape recorder going. At first she said, well, nobody will be interested in these stories. Let's just try it. So I started taping her and then I stopped it and I played it back to her and she starts laughing at her own stuff. So she said, okay. I assured her that I would make sure that she was part of the process and that to make sure that these stories were completely authentic according to the way she tells the story. So I wanted to, with these stories, preserve her stories, the way she tells the stories and the stories themselves. And it's a real wonderful record, really, what life was like in the 1930s and the 1940s in San Rafael in Marin County. We got through this and I recorded all these stories and worked closely with my aunt, making sure there was any changes that needed to be made. My publisher still said to me, now, I know you say your Annie Margaret's got a great memory, but you better check on some of the places that are mentioned, some of the little details, just to make sure everything's accurate. So I double-checked quietly, you know, every little detail that was in that book. Guess what? My aunt was 100% right on every detail, okay? She's got a mind like a steel trap. She's just really sharp. I included pictures of the dog, pictures of my Annie Margaret when she was a little girl, pictures of my father, and they're just adorable pictures. So put it together, and this is how we got Conversations with My Annie Margaret About Sporty Dog. That was my first book.
And I'd like to encourage my listeners to record the stories in their family as well. It's really important.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now we're segueing into fairy tales. Mm-hmm. How did the first one come about?
Well, actually, we have to go back 30 years, okay?
Oh, okay. All right, it is a fairy tale, so time traveling is allowed.
This happens, I guess, to a lot of people. It happened to me is, first of all, I suffered a heartbreaking from a loss of a love, okay? And things didn't work out, and so for some reason I thought, well, I'll just write a story about my feelings. And I wrote 5 stories initially. They just came out fairy tales. That just seemed like was a natural format for me. Like I wrote these and then I tucked them in a drawer and forgot about them for 30 years. So then after I got done with my Annie Margaret's book, I decided, well, I really wanted to pick up where I had left off, okay? I'd had another challenging situation in life. And it's funny because I remembered the fairy tales and how it had helped me feel a little bit better. But I think if you can get your feelings out and you're reaching out to people when you write, okay, I think that it would make me feel better. I picked up the original 5, I rewrote them, and then I was off and running. And I thought, well, I kept writing stories. I decided, well, why don't I keep writing and make this into a collection of fairy tales? And then after I wrote them, I wondered if they were original or were they like redos of existing fairy tales. So I went back then and I reread all of the Grimm stories, Hans Christian Andersen, and every other fairy tale book I get my hands on. And I just lucked out because from as far as I could tell, all of my stories were original. I went, okay. Then I was very fortunate to meet this young woman who was a friend of my stepson, Rose Fonte. And matter of fact, she actually helped out with the first book. I needed somebody to draw a dog for the first book. And Nathan, my stepson, said, hey, get Rose to do the dog. She's a wonderful artist. So she drew the dog. That was her first entry as an illustrator. So when I got into writing the fairy tales, I contacted Rose and I said, well, how are you with fantasy? And she said that was one of her great loves. So we got together and she ended up doing the cover for the book. We've gotten all kinds of great comments about. And she did an illustration, one for each of the 14 stories in the book. and she's got a very unique style. She's a completely self-taught artist. So it's almost like sometimes I think it's good if you don't have training, because what comes out is totally original. There's a lot of the fairy tale books I have looked at. It just seems like there's a homogenized form of art that you see in a lot of books these days, in the fairy tale books. But with the ones that she did for my book, they are really totally unique.
Now, I understand you originally had 13 fairy tales.
That's right. I started out with 13. It was originally 13. And my publisher said, hold everything. This is not going to work. And my editor was saying, no, you've got to either do 12 or 14, but not 13. People get pretty nervous with that number. So luckily, I had written a short little story. I almost had it in my back pocket. And I said, hey, I happen to have an extra fairy tale. And the funny thing is that one that was written so quickly and added at the last minute is one of the ones that people really like.
Funny how that works.
Good thing that I added that fairy tale.
Now, when you write these fairy tales, do you give yourself a word count limit or just...
Actually, the stories write themselves in my head. Usually like 4 o'clock in the morning, I wake up and I've got the story in my head.
It's always 4 in the morning, isn't it?
I don't know. Well, it's quiet. There's a real plus to 4 o'clock in the morning. And I tend to be a morning person anyway. So I get up and the story is just about written. So my first draft, you know, is written with total abandon. I just don't worry about anything. Punctuation, spelling, or any of those things, details, and it comes pouring out. So it comes out really, really quickly. Most of the work is done in the rewrite and the polishing. That's where I spend a huge amount of time. It's surprising how little time went into writing each of these stories. I mean, the initial draft. It's almost like I'm the conduit for these stories. It just comes rushing out, like I say. And I'm a little bit leery of computers. I'm from an earlier generation that didn't have computers. So I still get nervous that something might be deleted. So I always write out the first draft longhand, you know, just to make sure that there's not some kind of technical difficulty that makes any part of it disappear, because that would be terrible.
Now, what's some of the feedback you received from this book that addresses all ages?
I didn't really write them for a particular age group. I just wrote fairy tales, and I always like writing simply, because I think that way my ideas can be understood, I think, more clearly, more easily. Let's see, and you're asking, what did you ask me? I got so enthralled with myself. Okay, let's see now. Oh, there goes the concentration.
Some of the feedback you've received.
Oh, the feedback. That's right. Well, I was really surprised that as I would read these stories to some of my friends, I started with some of my friends, if it was a sad story, because some have happy endings, some sad, some in the air. If it was one of my sadder stories, I would look up and I would see my dear friends crying. And at first I was concerned for them, but then they actually assured me, said that my stories was touching something in their own experience. You know, it was almost validating something that they have experienced with my stories. And some people even said, how did you know this happened to me? I got that a lot. How did you know this has happened to me?
Universal.
Yeah, there was a lot of connections that were going on. One of the first stories that I read to my Toastmaster club, I am a member of Toastmasters, and I was reading one of my stories, The Dragon Slayer. And at first the guy said, oh, we have to hear fairy tales. But they got into the story and I heard them gasping and reacting like this. And I knew I had them in the palm of my hand.
Gotcha. So,
and the ending was not what they expected. No, this really can't happen this way. They were really traumatized. But I knew that had made a connection with them. I've always had this concern, the basic theme probably in my stories is how people do not cherish each other the way they should. There's so many lost loves that are going on in our lives, lost opportunities. And so these stories I'm trying to do is to gently, because I don't believe in hitting somebody over the head like, you need to do this and you need to do that and do it this way. I would rather kind of like just sort of prod people to think about things, just gently get people thinking along certain ideas, certain themes. I mean, I've lived a long time now, so I hope I will live to continue on for an even longer time. But I believe, again, I've lived long enough to have a few things I can share with people. And so this is what I'm trying to, share. And like I say, I hope that my stories give hope to people, because I had to go through a lot of tragedy myself, okay? You can survive. You really can survive and give yourself permission to love again. I think that's something that people need to hear.
And speaking of, I understand you hold candle-lit dinner.
Yeah, well, you see candles on my table. I'm ready to have a candle-lit dinner at a moment's notice. I enjoy that very much. It's so nice to dim the electrical lights. I have a chandelier. I have lots of chandeliers, you'll see, in my house. But I love candlelight, and everybody looks better in candlelight anyway. Have you noticed that? The nice glow of the candle? I know I look better in candlelight. Might as well, I want to look my best. But it's kind of nice to have the candles burning as you're having a wonderful meal and make it an experience. Again, people are in too much of a hurry. This is one of my other concerns about people. I myself was type A person, always in a hurry. I met Ken, and because he's got a little bit slower approach, I'm glad that I started picking up his pace rather than my own, because you miss a lot when you're in a hurry. The candlelight dinner, you have the candles going and we're enjoying a nice meal, but we're talking, and that's what I like to do. It really sets you up for conversation. When the candlelight's going, it turns it into a special occasion, because so many people don't use candles for dinner. They stop and get, you know, Jack in the Box, okay? There's no candles involved with that.
Although you could put on your nice dinner plate.
True. Now, you can work around. Yeah, you're right. Right. There's always ways.
You could work with it.
But
I want to point out to my listeners that these particular candlesticks that she has in her holders here are gold.
This is one of my other acquisitions. I'm always looking for things. I'm constantly on a treasure hunt. And aren't these beautiful? I found these at
the candle holders.
Yeah, aren't they beautiful? And little these Cupids. Are, of course, Victorian style. Every moment that you have, as much as you can, to make moments special, because you don't know how long you're going to be here, how long your friends are going to be here. You can lose somebody in a, I don't want to sound too maudlin, but you know, but you can lose somebody in a moment. You know, so you want to make good use of the time that you have. You know, that's what I would strongly urge people to do.
A candlelit meal is a good start.
Oh, yes. And it puts everybody in a good mood. And I even have a candle snuffer over there. So when we have our neighbors next door that we're very fond of, and they have two sons, and when they first started coming over, started snuffing the candle, they said, "Can we snuff the candles?" I said, "Of course." So, but you have to wait till the candles burn down a ways, you know.
And of course, one of the best parts of having a candlelit dinner is the stories that you can share.
Oh, and Linda's favorite writer, Hans Christian Andersen, naturally. Do something different. Wish upon a star.